we're going to begin this discussion, I mean this symposium, in true SNCC fashion, which means that Mr. Robert Zellner will raise a song. With your help, this is participatory, if not democracy something.
And I can see some old faces out there, so I know you know some of the old songs, but there's no such thing as an old song. They're all present. Let's try a few verses of, which is what I did this morning. I woke up with my mind on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Oh well, I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah. I think you can do better if you stand up while I do.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, no harm to keep your mind
stayed on freedom.
Oh, well, it
ain't no harm to keep your mind stayed. Ain't no harm to keep your mind stayed on freedom. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
Okay, you can do it. We'll do it some more.
There'll be a lot of time for discussion this afternoon. If any of you should want to talk with any of them about the role of musical culture in the movement, I suspect they all have something to say about that. I've got a couple of kinds of introductions to do right now. I've got to introduce the idea of the symposium, which is sort of officially beginning now, and then I want to introduce the speakers more or less, kind of, sort of. I think most of you know that what we're trying to do is to use a certain kind of history to help us explore and think about a certain kind of contemporary problem, right? You want to call it the insider-outsider problem, that's one way to do it, right? Insiders and outsiders, united in what is presumably some kind of common cause, and yet finding themselves unable to bridge those differences between them. I don't know if anybody, I hope my class did at least a little bit, look at the article by Marx and Yuseem on the website. What they frame it in terms of what happens when majority group people, people of privilege, become involved in minority group movements, right? What are the dynamics of that? And one of the reasons that that article is important and something you should get to after your exam, if you haven't done it now, right, is it naturalizes the phenomena, right? It says, if you look at the abolitionist movement of the 19th century in this country, you look at the movement against untouchability in India, and you look at the American Civil Rights Movement, and all of them you find that the minority reaches a point where it becomes uncomfortable with at least the original form of majority group involvement, right? And so that my favorite example of this, and forgive me, those of you who heard me say it before, right? Gandhi is one of the first Brahmin in India to step forward and to challenge the position of the untouchables. And when he first does that, the untouchables who don't have voice themselves welcome him, right, and welcome him as their voice. And then there comes a period in that movement where they say, he has to go. He has to go, right? But then Gandhi, at a later point in his career, is getting significant aid over a long period of time from an American cleric. But when the movement against the British in India reached a certain point, he asked that cleric to go back to the United States. He did what had been done to him from another perspective, right? But the point of the Gary Marx article, and they have an analysis, and some of this maybe we'll talk about at some point. I think that it'll come up naturally in some ways. An analysis of why these patterns tend to recur in history, right? The way in which this comes into our lives here at the University of Chicago, or wherever you are in Chicago, right? Is that every student that I know of who comes out of our Urban Teachers Program goes through a version of this, right? To what degree am I accepted by my parents, by my children? To what degree am I accepted in these communities where I am trying to help? I am going to work with their children. Everyone that I know comes out of this program. Actually, everyone I know, black or white, coming out of our program, goes through a version of that. All of our students doing social services in disadvantaged communities go through a version of that. All of our students who tutor or volunteer in our local communities, right? This whole notion of acceptance, lack of acceptance, and what lies underneath lack of, is obviously fraught with all kinds of emotional baggage. The title of this symposium, which has become famous, justly or unjustly, right? I want to be your friend, you black idiot. We'll talk tomorrow about the context of that title. Yes, yes, I have heard it from all kinds of sources. It's intended to express exasperation, and it's intended to express frustration. That's the voice of a person who thinks they are helping, who's sure they are helping. It comes out of the Mississippi Freedom Summer Project. Help meant a lot in that context. And they did not feel accepted in that context. It's that frustration, right, which that title is trying to capture. And I'm also trying to say that unless I'm blind, deaf, and dumb, that sense of frustration and exasperation is still an underlying part of how we talk about race on college campuses. The whole discussion about why they need to sit together at the lunch table is another form of that discussion, right? The exasperation with why do they do that, right? The exasperation in these conversations, I would argue, tell you much more about what's going on than the conversation themselves, right? It's that underlying emotional tone that people bring to it. And so we're going to spend a couple days trying to explore, to take apart, to understand some of these dynamics, explore that terrain. I expect a whole lot of disagreement. These people were certainly not chosen because I think they will agree with one another. You will see. I don't expect you guys to agree. What I expect and hope for is a real challenging and yet civil conversation, right? One that sort of pushes people, but doesn't push folk off the cliff, right? And so if we can manage to have 2 days of conversation and keep that tone of both seriousness and in the end some sense of connection with one another, not write one another off, not dismiss one another, because there are a lot of points in this conversation where you're going to be tempted to dismiss each other, then I will consider this conversation a success. No matter what happens, I'll consider it fun because I get to see five people I don't get to see very often, whom I admire a lot, from whom I have learned a lot, and, you know, I don't have any qualms that no matter what happens, we're all going to learn a lot in the next couple of days, right? So the more you can come, the better. Before I do my version of the intro, there was a young lady who had an announcement.
Okay, I just wanted to let everyone know about an event that will be taking place tonight, 7 p.m. Parker 140. It's entitled Dear President Obama, Lessons from Chicago on the Issue of Torture. We've invited Attorney Dan Willis from Black People Against Police Torture, Joey Mogul from the City Blog, and Aziz Huff from the University of Law School to come speak about the issue of torture in the U.S. Also, that's a very nice program, and we just like everyone to know about it and come out. Thank you. Thank you.
And there'll be anyone else who has announcements that I think will be of interest to the group. We'll make time. Let me not introduce them as individuals this time. I guess in some ways you could argue this is also to introduce them as a group rather than as individuals is in some ways consistent with some parts of a movement culture. What I have on the board is sort of a list, borrowing a page from Tim Uel Black, who is a friend of many people in this room. This is sort of their collective biography, right? These are the organizations, these are the movements, these are the actions, these are the issues. This is a very selective list. We did this in 5 minutes, right? Something before we got... Somebody remind me, what was GRO?
GRO was a grassroots organizing work, a project that was started when I left SNCC in 67, that went up to 97, and we also call it Get Rid of Wallace.
Is this the Pulpwood work of organizing black and white Pulpwood?
In the Deep South, black and white Pulpwood, going into Klan country and organizing whites and blacks together.
Okay. I'm just going to read you through this list, right? Oh, that's the goal. Those Pulpit Association, the NAACP, Shinnecock Nation, that too is Bob, protesting for Native American rights. SDS, NLF is National Liberation Front of Vietnam, and Howie was at one point the SDS representative to them, if my memory is right. The Stop the Drag Me, organizing against poverty, if my memory is right, on Chicago's west side, and of course, the Weather Man Underground. The White Folks Project, Southern Students Organizing Committee, the Institute for Policy Studies, which in my memory was sort of the first time people who consider themselves progressive had that kind of thing. Something else that I didn't, Southern Exposure, which some of you knew, grew out of some similar sets of work. Highlander Research and Education, boy, the number of folk that were affected by this and all of the movements in the 1960s would just be extraordinary. I bet you everybody at this table has had some kind of contact with Highlander. American Friends Service Committee, Chicago SNCC, Cheryl Friends of SNCC. Benjamin Willis was one of the first mass mobilizations of black people. He was the superintendent, and there was a movement in which Fannie participated to against him because of the deliberate segregation of the schools of the city of Chicago. Chicago Freedom Schools protesting against U.S. policy, against Salvador Allende in Chile. We left off, I left off.
Protesting the U.S.
I'm sorry, what did I say? His policy? No, protesting the U.S. policy, sorry. Puerto Rican Solidarity Committee should be up here. We left off several here, actually. And said National Christian Leadership Conference, the Harold Washington Campaign, protesting against apartheid in South Africa, the Third World Coalition, the Mass Party, intended to be a party of the masses. For almost everybody, again, is connected in some way or another affected by the Summer Project. Many people in this group were affected by Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, the Southern Christian Leadership Council of Federated Organizations, which is a council of the civil rights group operating in Mississippi. The Atlanta Project, in terms of the best single preparation of the stuff on the website for tomorrow's Black Power panel, the Atlanta Project position paper on race was one of the first times you got an articulation of stuff that black organizers and activists have been thinking about for a long time, and Zahara is one of its authors and developers. Protesting against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, the Middle East Peace Delegation, is that right? And the Southern Conference Educational Fund, which a couple of people participated in, right? If you wanted to outline American activism in the 1960s and 70s, Daniel, this ain't pretty close to what you come up with, right? All right, so what I'm trying to say is that this panel, Howard Mockinger, Bob Zellner, Sue Thrasher, Zahara Simmons, Fannie Rushing, they represent a hell of a lot of experience in this world, right? They represent lifetimes of struggling with these questions, right? So that probably calls for a round of applause for the collective. And the part of this that we're going to begin conversation, heaven knows where conversation is going to go, and that's completely unpredictable. But where we're going to begin conversation is with the relationship between, using the terms broadly now, black and white radicals in the 1960s, 70s, right? And how that played off one another. And Howard's going to start that conversation. Fannie is going to respond, make some remarks. And then we'll just sort of throw it open to anybody else, and then we'll just do exchange with the audience. So Howard? Sure. And I should say that for Howard, this is a homecoming of sorts. It was an unhappy home for him because they kicked his butt out of here. They expelled him from the sociology department at the University of Chicago in 1969 for a sit-in, which was about what?
It was a feminist professor of sociology, didn't get tenure, and then there were other issues connected to it.
Okay, so we're going to welcome him home, such home as it has been, and he's going to start us off, and I'll let you know about the time.
Okay. Well, you know, normally when you come back to a place that you spent some time, you say how happy you are to be back home. And I'll just say how interesting it is to be back here. And I do want to So I think the NLF would be surprised to hear that I was the SES representative to them. I actually was the representative to the Bertrand Russell War Crimes Tribunal in 1967. And that actually makes more of it than it was, too. But just, I think that's what Charles had in mind. I always told my students to never begin by apologizing, so I'm going to violate that right away, because this is kind of, this has the potential to be a little esoteric, the paper, because it's, I'm going to be talking a lot about some fairly, almost from another planet kind of discussions that were going on in the 60s. So I'd like you to help ground me by asking me questions or saying, what was that, or whatever, because it's, when you don't know who you're talking to, it's hard to be responsive to their concerns. So if you can communicate what your concerns are to me, that would be helpful. Can we not get that now?
I believe it's that black box right here.
Works a lot better that way.
Thank you.
So, what I'm going to talk about is the new left, and in this case, and this is wrong historically, we're going to talk a lot about SDS. SDS was not the whole new left by any means. But we're going to focus on their reaction to a moment of black initiative that's encapsulated in black power. Charles pointed out, we want to figure out a way to connect this to what your concerns are. And so some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about, I want you to just think about how much you think the economic situation for black people have changed, their educational situation, how much has urban life changed since then. And we're going to talk about concepts like white privilege, white guilt, and white cool. And one of the things I'm going to talk about is the connection between white cool and its relationship to race, and how cool whites, you know, you can go back to Norman Mailer's, The White Negro, to look at this, what essentially I think is a sick relationship between whites and black, their perceptions of black culture, and the kind of cool that you might get from that. And then the other point here of moral cachet is to think about how people today, the movements we grew up in grew out of this, were either constituted or grew out of the civil rights movement. And even though in retrospect people think everyone was in favor of civil rights when it happened, in fact it was highly contested, but the movement for civil rights had a certain moral cachet. And I want you to think whether today the struggles of black and brown people have that same kind of cachet in the society at large. So these are things I want you to kind of bear in mind as we move along here. There's people here who know a lot more about SNCC than I do, but the operative thing I want to talk about here is when the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee voted to expel whites, and how white leftists responded to that. That's the crux of the thing. So we need to start with SNCC, and if you want to hear about SNCC, probably you should direct it at other people here, though I have spent some time studying. And the two images there is to kind of trace the evolution of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And in the first one you see black and white holding hands there. And a slogan often associated with SNCC is the beloved, in parentheses, interracial community. And that was meant to signify that. And there you have Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, projecting a different image of SNCC than that. And there were, in many ways, for young white SNCC who were radical, was sort of the apple of their eye, partially because of this promise of interracialism, and secondly because it was everyone was a leader in SNCC, or that was the philosophy, and for a while quite true. People, the trappings of leadership that we so much associate with leadership was very much put down in that perspective, and so people felt this is real democracy. And then within SNCC, and we're going to talk about this a little bit, there's the rise of the Black Power perspective, which led in the end of 1966 to a vote where whites were asked to leave. And the vote was 19 to 18 with 24 abstentions, and probably there were 20 people whose vote was at 2 a.m. in the morning. Probably a lot of people just had checked out by then. And so you might think in a close vote like that, well, it could have gone either way, but in fact, the closest in the vote, I think, signifies how people were not willing to fight for interracialism, and it was worn out at that point. And so I want to talk about that for a minute, that after, particularly after 64, even though these questions had been there for a while, the interracialism inside SNCC became a question for people rather than an assumption. And I think there are two kinds of reasons for that that kind of get encapsulated in Black Power. The first is a growing feeling that black self-determination, without dependence on whites for money, for leadership, was what was needed at this point. And of course, connected to that, and so a part of that was honoring African American traditions, developing self-confidence and sense of capacity, and that the direction of the movement should not be determined by whites, but should be determined by black people, and not be dependent for support or encouragement. This was linked to the perception of the role of whites, and as I'm saying about the vote, there was a lack of energy to deal with whites. People didn't feel like that's what they really wanted to spend their energy. And I think part of the context for this is, I think it's not an exaggeration to describe the Southern movement as heroic. And yet, there was extremely little response in the white community at large to that heroism of people going into these Jim Crow situations at risk of life and doing incredible things, registering people to vote, and so on. There's very little response in society at large. In fact, the biggest response was in the Mississippi summer of 64, and there's been at least one terrible movie made about this, where two whites, and they don't even name the black person, are killed, and it becomes a national scandal. The first news reports just named the white people. And so that's part of the context, and then there's the perceptions of what the interactions between often educated northern whites are and people in the Mississippi community that they're coming to work with. There's issues around that. This, we'll talk about Malcolm X in a minute, but he often spoke of be more concerned about what he called the sly white foxes than the wolves at the door. And there were questions raised about the motives of white people. Were they there to help? Were they there because they thought that was where the action was, because it gave them cachet in the larger society? Were they in some ways affecting this attempt at black aspiration? And also, there was also a question whether they were just escaping from their own issues and working them out in a different context. So I see that the movement toward black power, whatever one thinks of it, was overdetermined. there was really a lot of things pushing in that direction. And it's hard to me to see that another direction at least wouldn't have been important. And, you know, even though, let's say, King was not an advocate of Black Power, though he didn't lead the critique of it by any means. He kind of mostly kept quiet, but that wasn't the direction. You have to think of that he was, in a sense, the Black Power impetus kind of overwhelmed him toward the end of his life in terms of what was electrifying people's consciousness, especially in northern urban communities and so on. This was a very popular move. Okay. So, how did whites react to the fact that whites had been kicked out of the Student Nonviolent Committee, out of SNCC? And I would categorize the reaction in two ways. One are the set of leftists who basically try to ignore or condemn Black Power. And chief among them is a group that I think still exists. It's called the Progressive Labor Party. And their notion, they, I guess you would call them a kind of stereotype Marxist position, in which they saw any kind of Black Power or Black nationalism, which are not exactly the same thing, but they work together, as divisive, that the working class needed to be united. If there was Black Power, it would divide whites from blacks, and you couldn't have a unified working class movement. And they didn't confine this to a critique of Black nationalism. They opposed Vietnamese nationalism on the same count, and that what you needed was a worker movement. And so racism for them was a set of bad ideas that the ruling class used to divide workers from each other. And the reason they did it was they made more money off of super exploiting black people. So that's why they did that. And so they didn't mind. Then the Communist Party USA had a more, I'm not going to, if someone wants to know more about this, I'll go into it. It's a long, complicated Talmudic history. But they basically, at this point, had decided that the blacks didn't constitute a nation. They didn't attack black nationalist groups because the Communist Party at that time was fairly isolated, and anyone who wanted to work with them, they would work with. And their slogan, similar to PL's, but not as kind of brittle and hard edge, was black and white, unite and fight. That's what the strategy should be. Then Greg Calvert was an SDS member, and he thought that the problem that whites should find their own issues and not tail after black people. And he made a distinction between liberals, and in those days, just to put it in context, the worst thing a radical could say about someone was that they were a liberal. Liberals fought someone else's battles, and so whites needed to find an issue, their own issues. And so he, for instance, for a while was partisan of this thing called New Working Class Theory, and I'll just say a word about it. The New Working Class were generated by the new technology, and there were all these workers who were going to be in computers and stuff like that, and they were more very key to production, more important than the old working class, and they presumably were what was responsible for the rise of a white movement, the white new left, were these workers. Turns out that if you look at the people who participated in these movements, they generally were not technical students or anything like that. But anyway, it was an attempt to find a white perspective, a white issue, a white thing. And then, so that's the people who say basically, well, this Black Power is bad or a phase, we'll ride it out. And then the people who I kind of hung out more with were people who wanted to figure out a positive way to relate to Black Power. And the problem I had with someone like Calvert is it wasn't responsive at all to the civil rights movement, except I'm not going there. And it didn't really understand race as central to American history, to white identities, that racism was at least as important an issue for whites as for blacks, because racism constituted part of their identity in a fundamental way. And they understood black power not as an anti-white message, but as a message that you're not going to get past these racial issues painlessly by saying it's all cool now that we have the Civil Rights Act or something. And then also they realized that the issues around white control were real, as Charles implied in these other, you know, they really know when they were, when it was real or not, it's highly contested. That whites needed to just get back. Well, whether whites were capable of getting back, we'll see as we go on with the story here. And these were issues, these questions were issues that if you were going to take this position, you kind of had to deal with. One is, what's the relationship between race and national struggle and the class struggle? What's the relationship between working people or poor people and the black freedom movement? And what's the relationship between the black freedom struggle and, remember, this is a period, as was implied in the thing, where there's a revolution happening in many places around the world. Cuba had just had a revolution. And Vietnam was where a lot of people's energy was focused. And, you know, so an analysis might be something like, blacks have a similar relationship to American imperialism as Vietnamese. They're an internal colony. They're oppressed, and it's the same struggle. That might be one way to answer that question. And then finally, okay, well, if race is core, how are you going to actually organize whites to deal with this? So there was an alternate Marxist take to the one that denied that black power or black nationals or anything like that was progressive or interesting, and it goes back to Lenin. And Lenin had been, one of the things that shocked Lenin was during World War I, when World War I broke out, before that there had been all these proclamations that the working class would never fight an imperialist war, that they would stand united and keep war from happening. So then World War I happened, and with only minor exceptions, all of the working socialist parties sided with whatever their country's government in the war. And so Lenin wanted to come to terms with this, and he said, well, there is, and he came to terms with it in a few ways. The first is that not all nationalism is bad. If you have an imperial power oppressing another country, that country's nationalism could be progressive in a way, and so you would put Vietnam under that rubric. And then secondly, that there were whites who were in countries like the US or Britain, imperial powers, who had privileges because let's say Great Britain exploited people in Africa, and the working class of Britain benefited by that exploitation and could get better wages and get other kinds of advantages. So there was that the working class had certain privileges. Then there was also the common turn, I don't want to go into this, but at one point they passed a resolution that said there was actually a black belt nation in 5 states in the South, South Carolina. Yeah?
Can we be specific about who was the author of that, i.e. Harry Haywood, please?
Well, I mean, Harry Haywood was...
because it comes up again in the formation of the Communist Labor Party.
Mm-hmm. So he was someone who actually was in Moscow and worked on these the Black Belt thesis, and said there was a black nation in these Black Belt states, and therefore blacks constituted a nation. Since then, the Communist Party had said goodbye to that point of view, but this was revived by certain Marxists. And this is all So this is all trying to find a way to talk about black nationalism or black power in a way that Marxists could support. And then there's Noah Nathan, I guess he's now goes by Noah Gnadiobia, 5 minutes ago. Anyway, he came up with an influential thesis called The White Blind Spot, in which he talked about white privilege, which I'm going to, we can talk about it in the question period, because I want to get to it. And this was a notion that, playing off of Lenin's thing, that white workers got privileges, and that the problem with American history and the lack of revolution had been that in various periods, whether it was Reconstruction, populism, the New Deal, and potentially now, whites had sold out black initiative and kept a revolutionary movement from development. Now, all this talk was the preoccupation of maybe 100 people inside SDS. But what wasn't a preoccupation of that was the riots that had happened in Watts and Detroit and the rise of the Black Panther Party and also Malcolm X. And this was stuff that many whites were aware of. And a critique of nonviolence emerged since I only have 5 minutes. You can read that. That basically it was undignified in some profound way. And here are some quotes from Malcolm X. How can you be nonviolent in Mississippi as violent as you were in Korea? And if violence is wrong in America, violence is wrong abroad. And if you want to talk about revolution, revolution is bloody, revolution is hostile. And he saw Vietnam as part of a worldwide black revolution. And I can talk about this. I saw Malcolm X right before he died. And he the thing that got to me the most in what he said is, we're always talking about black people as a minority, but if you look at the world, black people are not a minority, they're a majority. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I never thought of that before, and it's true. And anyway, and along with that came Frantz Fanon, and his book, The Wretched of the Earth, which probably most of you heard, was translated into English in 1963. And he had a therapeutic view almost of violence, and we can go into that more, that violence was cleansing and therapeutic for the colonized, and that colonialism was such an intense experience, and either the violence would be directed inward or outward, and so better outward against the colonizer. And along with this, it's worth mentioning, Jean-Paul Sartre wrote an introduction to it, to Wretched of the Earth. And we can talk about this later, but there's a kind of conflict between Camus, the pacifist, who temporized on French imperialism in Algeria, and Sartre, who became a strong opponent in the Vietnam War. And he writes about how, and he contributes to this critique of nonviolence, as he calls it, what's going on in the Third World is a striptease of European humanism that's basically a racist humanism, and that you dig beneath European civilization to see the racist bedrock of European civilization, and that violent revolution was kind of the just desserts for arrogant Europeans. And this went along with a critique of violence, of nonviolence, as being complicitous in this rape of the Third World. So this, and I would say to say that everyone was reading Fanon in this period on the left. Okay, so that's the context of this. So one way SDS, so you have the rise of the Panthers in this period, and the way SDS thought it was going to resolve this problem of how to deal with black power was around this concept of supporting black leadership. And then in fact, if you follow black leadership, that was equivalent to being anti-racist. Now this left unanswered certain questions that we can explore, which is which leadership to follow, because there wasn't one black group to follow. And what does leadership mean? If whites are following black leadership, how are black leadership accountable? How are differences to be worked out? All these things were basically not explored. But this became And here the Panthers enter the picture. And there's this growing struggle. Progressive Labor, the group I talked about that said all nationalism is reactionary, is getting stronger and stronger in SDS. And the people who want to sort of figure out a relationship to black power see the Panthers as the way to defeat PL. And so in this national conference, one of the last meetings of SDS, SDS names the Black Panther Party as the vanguard force in the black liberation struggle. And I'll come back to the other slide. And this is the response of Julius Lester, who had been in SNCC and The Guardian, in which he basically says, thank you, white folks, for telling us who the black leaders of the black revolution are. Without you, we couldn't have figured it out. And you know, basically, he talks about how arrogant this move was. I'll give you a second to read those. Those are some of the milder comments in there. Now, at this point, one of the things SDS is typically ignorant of is that there's negotiations going on between some SNCC people and the Black Panthers to come together. And yet, here's an example of the differences they have. Stokely Carmichael, later Poincaré, he's not at all into socialism. He thinks racism is what's important, more important than exploitation or class issues, that black people and African people with an African ideology and strategic goal is the Black United Front. Newton, Huey Newton, who you've all heard of, had much more of a race-class analysis. And what people don't understand about the Panthers is, in fact, they were a nationalist group that was very much open to working with white people. And they were socialists, and they made distinctions between different kinds of nationalism, which they famously critiqued what they call pork chop nationalism. And they wanted to work with white mother country radicals, and that the problem with SNCC had been controlled by white liberals. Cleaver, Eldridge Cleaver, joined the Panthers, and he had been a former black Muslim when he was in prison. And he was much into recognizing the vitality of the white movement. And this is a quote from him, that there's a generation of white youth that is truly worthy of a black man's respect. And this was, as I put it in my paper, balm on the wounds of Peg Leg Bates for many white people. Oh, now we're good. We got someone who says we're good. So this is part of the move. So then there's the next meeting of SDS was the end of SDS. There was a national convention held right here in Chicago. I think the Civic Center probably doesn't exist. It was a really barren, awful place. And SDS, the pro-black power faction, now called Revolutionary Youth Movement, thought PL had been defeated with this Panthers as the vanguard resolution. In fact, PL comes to this conference in power, even though they in no way represented half of SDS. They had about half of the people at the convention. And so again, people asked the Panthers to come to their rescue. And the Panther leaders get up at this thing, and they famously give a speech which says, you know, anyone who thinks that all nationalism is reactionary can't be part of the revolution. And then they talk about pussy power as the role of black women. And so basically the whole convention's in turmoil. SDS splits at that point between a PL-led and a RIM-led thing. And it only passes two resolutions. One is that there'll be a national action against the war in Chicago in the fall of 69, and to go to the United Front Against Fascism conference that the Panthers are calling. The Panthers at this point are in tremendous attack. A lot of people are in jail, and they want the support of the white movement. And they call this big conference, about 3,000 people, probably three quarters white. The first evening, Herbert Aptheker, who is a famous historian, but also a member of the Communist Party, talks on and on into the night. And SDS meets with the Panthers, and two things happen at this meeting. SDS says, we spent the last year and a half arguing for the importance of white privilege, and you want us to organize for community control in the white community, and it's not the same situation as in the black community. You're asking us to go back on our analysis of white privilege, so we're not going to back you up. Secondly, they bring out a guy who they say, this is the kind of white person we want, and this is a person that SDS knows correctly to be a police agent. The point is that within 6 months, SDS had named, chosen the Black Vanguard, and broken with the Black Vanguard. And that was kind of the trajectory of the notion of supporting black leadership. I wanted to read you, at some point I might read you the quotes of the Panthers' reaction to SDS's disavowal of them. And basically they say, we're going to beat up you sissy counter-revolutionaries. That's almost a quote. Okay, so what do we make of all this? I mean, it sounds fairly ludicrous, but in many ways. And I think a few things, and we can talk about this more, is how different in many ways the black movement and the white movement were. Including, you could say, black power and so on represented a kind of coming home for black people, and whereas the white left was kind of running away from home, if you want to encapsulate the differences that way. And so, you know, I just heard about they had a 40th reunion of the Columbia Rebellion, and there is another example of black students kicking white students out in the middle of a demonstration, and the first thing that the black students did was clean up the building because the whites had made such a mess. And I think that captures some of the differences. And of course, religion, I mean, a lot of religion is very crucial, and we can talk about this in the black movement. Most of the white movement is kind of militant and atheist. And in general, the white movement is more alienated than reattaching or attaching itself to a strong cultural tradition. There's a real difference there. So we can look at this. Usually you put the pluses first and the minuses second, but in this case I think the minuses are pretty strong, so I put them first. And what happened was what you could describe as a parasitic relationship in which, you know, people talk about guilt by association. Here we have a strategy of legitimacy by association. And a blindness to complexity of black. This chapter that I wrote, this piece is drawn from a larger piece in which I talk about how the new left is similarly blind to complexities in the international movement. A strong PC tendency, and that it's a recipe for bad faith between whites and blacks, in which they're not real relations. The other thing I want to say is there are very few social relations at the time amongst people, you know, only a few interracial relationships, and it's not unusual. The Panther case, sitting at the University of Chicago, which I was involved in, the kind of liaison between the whites and the blacks also turned out to be a police agent. And it's a product of where you don't have real relationships, it's an easy place for the police to come in. And just so we don't, it's not a total downer, you're never supposed to be a total downer, I think there are some things in this that are worth thinking about. Even a failed but an honest attempt to try to deal with the depth of racism in American society, and it launched many people on lifetimes of focusing on this, and that this was an issue for whites as much as black, that there was a tremendous, and you know, people act like black studies or the critique of Eurocentrism came out of the academy, but in fact the initiative for all of those things came out of the movement. And that's a sea change in thinking about the world. I wouldn't underestimate. Not that SDS was responsible for that, but they were a small part of that. And then lastly, the limitations of the Civil Rights Act or purely legal solutions, this is what people are trying to cope with. They see that this isn't enough. And whereas the media and the establishments are acting, well, we pass this law, and this law, racism is over. So, that's all.
I don't have a paper or a PowerPoint. Perhaps what I think I'd like to do is just raise some questions. Okay, it's the first time everybody ever complained that I wasn't loud enough. All right, so I just want to raise some questions, and I'd like to raise them with the other people on the panel as well as people in the audience. The two questions and then third a comment. The first question is about this premise that initially SNCC was predicated on the building of a beloved interracial community. That's just something I'd like for people to talk about. The second question I'd like to raise for all of us is really, what is at stake in discussing the relationship between white and black radicals in the 1960s? I mean, why do we care? Then the third is a comment about the nature of theory and struggle. Because when we talked, or when we talked in the presentation, and I'm just saying these are things that raise questions for me. It's a very important history. The thing that is missing, and nothing can ever accomplish everything, but one of the things that I find missing is, whereas there is this progression of the left, or the white left, and its ideas about the nature of race, but what is missing is that beyond black power, what's the analysis and development of conceptualizations of race and struggle within the black community? And for me, the importance of black power is that it leads people beyond black power. Because when you start to talk about black power, whether it's Stokely or Owusu or any number of other people in that moment, they have to be cognizant of this connection with Africa. And what's going on in Africa is a revolution on the continent. And as part of this revolution, revolutionaries within Africa are having to confront the issues of race and class. And so, for example, you begin to get people such as Amilcar Cabral, revolution again, and starting to develop theories of a radical left position that is entwined with blackness. And we could go on and on and on, but that is an important trajectory for me anyway in terms of how an independent black left tradition begins to develop that is not connected to SDS or white liberals. So those are just three questions.
No, I think we'll open it up. I have some things, but they're all good questions. That'll be my response.
Of the other panelists, did any of you want to make any comments on any part of this before we open up the whole room?
I'd like to. I'd like to try to put it into a context, the question of majority participation in minority struggles. And to pose a couple of questions to think about. And they were questions that Claiborne Carson posed in the introduction, I think, to the second or third edition of his book on SNCC. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating, or In Struggle, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Claiborne Carson mentioned in that foreword that in the middle to the late 60s, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee made several basic decisions that affected its future action. He said in that discussion that as SNCC moved away from the original purpose of SNCC into a different phase, it gave up several weapons that SNCC had used very effectively for creating revolutionary and deep-going change in the United States. And he named those weapons. He called it the use of nonviolent direct action. He called it grassroots community organizing. He called it interracial work. At least those three things. He said those were weapons that had carried SNCC a long, long way to achieving its original aims. He said that in the latter part of the 60s, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee moved in various ways to give up those weapons. And he said as it moved into a more nationalist position, that the question had to be to the people who were advocating the removal or the leaving of those weapons, of those tactics and those strategies. What weapons, tactics, and strategies did the Black Power movement offer in the place of those weapons that had gotten the movement thus far? He didn't imply that they weren't such things, but he asked, what are they? Now, the other thing that I'll leave you with in this discussion as well, in the study of SNCC's role in American history, a little bit of the irony of SNCC being totally worn out with interracial work, which was very difficult and very hard. I can give you personal testimony on that fact. It's very difficult to do, very hard to do, and very hard to sustain without getting, as Howard said, worn out on interracial work. We're simply worn out. We're simply bitter that it takes the murder of white northerners to bring this country to realize the massacre and the oppression that's going on in the South. But he said, but I would say there was a certain irony as SNCC, that had been an inclusive organization, moves toward a more exclusivist position at the same time that the great black prince of nationalism, Malcolm X, is moving from an exclusivist position to a more inclusive position, based not on the color of people's eyes and skin, but based on their revolutionary content. Because he said he'd been to Mecca and he had seen fellow Muslims and so forth with light skin and blue eyes. So what is the irony of SNCC that had been inclusive moving to a more exclusive position at the same time Malcolm X is moving in the opposite direction?
Greetings, everyone. I wanted to, can everybody hear me? I have a very loud voice. Speak to the first question you raised and possibly also to address what you just mentioned, Bob. First of all, was SNCC based on the idea of an interracial beloved community? And I don't think that was the beginning of SNCC by any means. I think, you know, when you look at the beginnings of the sit-ins, it was, you know, about basic rights, basic dignity, etc. And as a high school student, when I saw, you know, on television, these young people being dragged off these stools at Woolworths, at you know, all the various places and coffee poured on their heads and, you know, all of this thing. It wasn't about having an interracial community. That was definitely not what came to my mind. It was like, oh my God, we're finally fighting, you know. I mean, so I think I was in the 10th grade, and of course, it was, and once I went to Atlanta and got involved as a student at Spelman, you know, it was about, you're not going to do this to me anymore. I mean, you are not going to tell me I got to go in an alley, get in the back of some stinking dirty place for you to hand me a, you know, a hamburger. Or I got to walk up to the nosebleed section to get in a theater. I mean, I can't go to the library. I can't go here. I can't. You're not doing this to me anymore. So it really wasn't about building an interracial community at that point. I mean, it was about basic rights, basic dignity. Now, I think that, and another point, as I remember, because as a member of the coordinating committee, because just to back up a little bit, for those of you who may not know, initially, the reason it was called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was because on college campuses, black schools around the South, you had elected people who served on the coordinating committee initially. This is before SNCC became much more a staff-led organization. So I was elected to, I was at Spelman, and we had one of these coordinating committees made up of representatives from all of the black schools in the Atlanta Center. So I was on that committee, and I remember very well, in spite of my decreasing memories, the discussion about what is going to, you know, the Mississippi Summer Project was being discussed, and the people from the Mississippi staff who would come into town, who, you know, we revered them, you know, Bob Moses and all the guys and women from the Mississippi field staff. There were real concerns about what it was going to mean to carry out this Mississippi Summer Project, which meant you were going to bring in 800 to 1,000 white college students in the Mississippi to be able to try to crack the state. While people understood, and in a lot of ways, we students who were members of the coordinating committee who were going to have to vote on whether to go forward with this were really being guided by the field staff. And there was ambivalence about bringing the whites in while knowing that this would bring attention, possibly protection, etc. There was also, what is this going to do to our movement? Lastly, I can say that while there were always, you know, some white members of SNCC, they did not make up the numbers where you had this change that happened after you had large numbers of whites as either volunteers or as staff. So prior to that, there was already this concern about what is going to happen. When I joined the movement, I absolutely saw it as a predominantly black-run, black-led, and certainly people like Jim Foreman, whom I adored and looked up to, these were the idols. These were black men and women, Ruby Doris Robinson, I mean, who were leading our movement. And so it really wasn't for me, and I don't know if I'm representative, of building the beloved community. I heard that more from SCLC, from Dr. King, this whole concept of building the beloved interracial community coming from the more religious people in the community.
Mm-hmm. So Harold, before you say, do you want to say anything about this notion? What were the weapons of black power?
You're getting me. I can understand, you know, having read Carson's book a few times. You know, I think in some ways, without understanding at what stage the people who were promoting black power were at when basically the whole thing fell apart and being SNCC, even though it lasted, you know, some time, but it was greatly weakened when the money was pulled out from under it. So, you know, when I talk about black power tomorrow, you know, clearly there were some, there were moves made before they should have been made. There had not been the thinking out of things that obviously needed to have been thought out before, in my opinion now, in retrospect, of what was being promoted. I mean, so if you're talking about, and I'm just thinking about this now because obviously Bob having thrown it out, I mean, I guess one of the first things would be self-determination, the whole sense that black people had been terribly damaged psychologically. I mean, you know, and I know for the young people in this room, I mean, you know, it's pretty hard, I'm sure, for you to imagine what it meant growing up in a white terroristic society. And I mean, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, and as we used to say, the main street of the Mississippi Delta began, I mean, the Mississippi Delta began on the main street of Memphis, Tennessee. So while, you know, there was some facade of civility, you knew if you got out of your place what would happen to you in Memphis, just like you would happen to you in Clarksdale, et cetera. So, you know, the whole thing, I think, of helping black people overcome the years of intimidation, oppression, et cetera, that would certainly be a weapon to help have black folk come into their own as full human beings with a right to determine their own destiny. I don't think that there was any sense, I can speak for those of us on the Atlanta Project, that we were going to give up grassroots organizing. So I didn't agree with Carson. I mean, the whole idea, of course, was urban organizing, which is what we were engaged in, and a continuation because we allied with people over in Alabama who were still, you know, organizing the Black Panther Party. They were doing the same organizing that had always been done. Now, the whole issue of interracial work, I think, in a lot of ways, as Howie was saying, you know, it was tiring. It was extremely tiring when you're trying to deal with your own self-hatred. I mean, look, you know, as a black person born when I was born and brought up when I was brought up, you were constantly dealing with your own notions of inferiority. I mean, the only thing you've seen on TV is Amos and Andy and Tarzan, one white man ruling Africa. I mean, and his best friend is a monkey, a chimpanzee. I mean, this is what I saw every Saturday when I went to the movies. I'd never seen anything in a movie on television that affirmed me. You know, it was Gone with the Wind and a Black Man. I mean, you know, this is, I mean, I'm dealing with trying to overcome all of this. So if I've also got to struggle with white folks who have also seen me all their life as an inferior person, I've got
have to fight with them over the direction in which my movement, as I saw it then, I don't see it that way now, should be going. You're damn right. It was tiring, exhausting. I'm trying to get my own stuff together.
Thank you. Yeah, that's one sort of framing comments for the students, right? Yeah. So how I like to think about that.
And then can I make a short response after that?
After that, you got it. Okay, that's fine. You can.
Let me just say this before I think.
I'm sorry. I think all of you know what I mean when I say there's a master narrative in the way American history is constructed. Not a master narrative of race has certain very predictable kinds of tropes, right? One is that the higher the status of a person or a group, the more that person or group's role in history will be amplified, right? And so we talk about whites more than blacks, northerners more than southerners, the least more than non-elites, right? In this history, what that means is that whatever white folk do gets a certain kind of application, right? That whatever black folk do, they're not going to get that same level of application, right? So without taking, I go back and forth about this, what is the role of interracialism in an early state? I can never have found that many black folks who said that's what we're about, or who even think beloved community means beloved interracial community. Mm-hmm. That's an interpretation of some people, right? I'm just saying it plays into that larger issue. One. Two. The other trope that I think that we should all be aware of is a trope between dividing the movement into the good civil rights movement in the South and the bad black power movement, bad and ineffective black power movement in the North. This question about the weapons of civil rights, the weapons of black power, that's complicated. I'm glad to hit the table early. We'll fight all day tomorrow about this, right? But since we're standing at this elite institution, I want to say real clearly, we know how these damn institutions opened up. They opened up because of those riots in 68. We can go through the papers of these institutions and find a moment in time when they said you have to have black faces on this campus.
Right.
In June, July of 68.
Thank you.
When they think this society is going to burn. It is not the weapons of the early civil rights movement that creates this massive access to a whole new class of people, right? To a certain part of the middle class and the upper middle class, right? You know, all y'all know, I ain't knocking the early civil rights movement for what it did, right? But I also want to be real careful about framing a conversation that falls back into that, to those basic tropes. But I also want people to be aware. These are two themes that we're going to be hammering on today and tomorrow, right?
I just want to make one is what people were. I'm not an expert on the history of SNCC. I wasn't in SNCC. My point is what whites made of SNCC. That's sort of the whole point of everything I'm saying. And this point of whites don't pay. I mean, I'll give an example from Vietnam. I ran into an old friend of mine who had been an activist against the war, and I've been going to Vietnam on and off for the last 10 years. And this person who had been an anti-war activist asked me if Vietnam was one country. It is, in case you don't know. And, you know, it had something to do with the outcome of the war. But they had paid no attention, even though they'd been an anti-war movement, to what actually happened in Vietnam. The Vietnam anti-war movement was about them and their what they brought to it. And I think that's one of the main points I want to make is what, as if you're going as a majority person into a minority group, what are you bringing with you? What are your needs? And we can talk more about this. What's your baggage and what are your perceptions? We can talk about, you know, the early SNCC, but my point is what, how are whites reading it? And, you know, what, and just to go to Charles' point, you know, the only thing I think I've ever learned from cultural studies is sort of the trope of the Garden of Eden. We used to live in the Garden of Eden, and then we've been, you know, we're away and we've been in decline since then. And I think that's, we do want to, I think one of the ways we want to understand the later part of the thing is that the issues were developing that people had to figure out how to deal with over time. They were issues that were coming up. And it's not like there was this great period before everybody was cool with each other, but as the movement evolved, new issues came up, and the question is how do people cope with them? And it's not about it's a decline or it's an up. And how, you know, it means you do evaluate and you do assess it, but not from this kind of simple-minded view.
Thank you.